on this chilly Florida morning here in Tampa. Chilly, for those of you who don't live in Florida, means in the 40s. So before we work our way to the present, I just want to spend a little time reviewing, since we are still in the beginning of a new year. And for those of you who have not been part of the last several talks over these past weeks, let me give a little summary. So several weeks ago, before Christmas, I gave a Dharma talk called The Dharma of Scrooge, something I've been doing for many years, sort of in an abbreviated way, reading the story of the Christmas carol and using the life of Scrooge as a model of practice, of transformation, of awakening. And so it's good for us to just spend a moment reviewing, because again, we all exist in the world of short attention span. We often don't reflect and remember deeply, so it's important that we touch places within ourself that help us remember things of significance. So just very simply, Scrooge was a suffering human being. That's where we encounter him. We meet him in the present, the same way we meet many people in the present. And we see their suffering in many ways. But through a series of visitations, we learned more about Scrooge. And he learned more about himself, which is really, it's a process of self-discovery. We looked into Scrooge's history. And we saw the causes and conditions that brought him to that sort of, to his aloneness, his misery, his anger, his hurt, by understanding his past. So that was sort of the first great learning. But the other important thing is when he went back into his past, it wasn't only to see the sources of his suffering. He also saw that there were times in his life when he was happy, when he was different than he had become. And that's very important too, because just to be in touch with suffering and not to be in touch with the absence of suffering, just to be in touch with unwholesome, afflictive emotions and not to be in touch with wholesome and positive ones, just to be in touch with you know, the disappointments of life and relationship and not to be in touch with the things that are meaningful and helpful and positive is skewed. So he really was able to see both. And we were able to see both. He was able to learn. Then he experienced Christmas present, and we know how he celebrates Christmas, alone, in misery. He was shown that there are many other people who experience the present in very different ways. They have happiness, they have relationships, they have meaning, they have celebration. Very important, again, for us not to, again, be stuck. Oftentimes we get stuck within the unfolding of our karma, especially the negative. We get stuck within our issues, within our problems, within our emotional afflictions, and we can't see outside of them. So he was able to get outside of himself and see that even in the present, there were many different ways of experiencing the present. And then his third one, and again, I'm going quickly, was the future. And he saw that if he did not change, if he continued to live the way he lived, think the way he think, behave the way he behaved, speak the way he speak, he would continue to live in misery and he would die in misery. That was very clear to him. But of course, by then, he had had these other experiences and he was terrified of having to continue on the way he's always lived. And so we know, that when he realized that the whole experience he had was sort of a dreamlike experience and not real, and that he was alive, and it was a new day, and he could step out of his conditioning. That was his enlightenment. He stepped out of his conditioning. And he decided from now on, he would be very different. So that was the story of Scrooge. Then on New Year's, if you remember, we had a beginning a new ceremony together, which was really our own experience of what we had learned the week before. Because there were many things that happened within that beginning anew, but it was, in the beginning, a reflection on the past year. We took stock, we took inventory, and we especially reflected on the actions of our body, speech, and mind of the past year that had caused suffering to ourselves and or others. Patterns of behavior, patterns of reactivity, patterns of response, sins of omission and sins of commission. Not only the things that we did, but the things that we didn't do, we could have done. In our own brief way, we experienced the process that Scrooge had gone into. And we ended by writing them down, all our regrets for the past year, and symbolically letting them go and having them burnt. And then we had a whole part of the ceremony in which we look forward to this new year. And everybody who was there, and maybe those who weren't there, but in your own way, like Scrooge, we thought, we set the intention to do this coming year differently. In big ways, in small ways. But the most important thing, in ways that will be transformative for our life. Not that we would immediately experience transformation, but that our life going forward in 2021 would be a step forward or movement in the direction of where we want to go in our life, how we want to be. And hopefully we understand that our desire to be different involved others. I mean, Scrooge's great awakening was he stepped out of his aloneness. He stepped out of his narcissism. He stepped out of his self-centeredness. Because we know that, in that chapter, he dedicated himself to doing for others, to bringing happiness to others, both personally, financially, in all the ways that he could. So we have to also, in our aspirations, see that our own individual, personal movement in a certain direction is also a movement that we want to make for our family, our friends, our community, our world. So today's date is the 10th. So let us all take a moment to reflect. We're now 10 days. Some of you may have your aspirations and intentions nearby. Some of you may just have to check our memory, but this is important. How are we doing? And certainly this past week has been a great help for many of us. And I'll talk about that in a few moments. I mean, have we even thought about? Why don't we start there? Have we even thought about the intentions we set 10 days ago? Do we remember them? Have they been part of our life in the last 10 days? You know, maybe the first intention we should have set back on the first was to remember our intentions. Have we remembered our intentions? Have we got up every morning and read them to remind ourselves, this mind that flickers in so many different directions? And not only have we set the intention early in the morning when we begin our day, but have we checked in with them throughout the day? Have we at the end of the day assessed, how did I do today? This is the way we change. There's a technology of change. And anybody who wants to change and transform just has to participate in that. And again, the key thing is to have a clear intention for your life, to make it very concrete and real, to actualize it every day to the best of your ability, to assess and reassess. That is the energetic way of moving your life in a new direction. And we know that A Christmas Carol ends in the last chapter, in the last words, we're saying that Scrooge actually kept to his word. He was the best of men. He was the best of friends to everyone and anyone. So we know he worked it. So again, please just take a moment. You know, we can do a little now, but later. This is important. The path of the Buddha is the path of transformation, of awakening, of freedom from suffering, of the actualization of the wholesome. And as we know, for those of us who've lived through this past week, we know the need for this only becomes greater. And if not us, who? We who have the good fortune of encountering the path. We who have learned the practices and the teachings of the path. We who have a community of friends to support us on the path. If not us, who? So please just kind of, let's just touch into where we were maybe 10 days ago. Even if we've completely forgot. Beginning anew doesn't just have to be once a year. Beginning anew is really every day. Beginning anew is really every moment. We commit, we recommit. How often do we recommit? As many times as we need to. It's like people get frustrated, you know, when because their meditation, they get distracted. They think at a certain point they shouldn't have to keep keep bringing themselves back. And sometimes they ask me, how long does this go on? And I say, well, you know, until you don't have to anymore. then you'll know you don't have to. But as long as you continually get lost, we have to get back on the path. We have to strengthen that muscle. It's a muscle. Mindfulness is a muscle. Living a life of intention and aspiration is a muscle. For many of us, it's a weak muscle. Discipline is the muscle. And like any muscle, it only gets strong by using it. We know that when it comes to our bodies. If we want a healthier body, stronger body, we have to work it. We can't just wish it. We can't just, a lot of people, they exercise with videos. You can't just watch the videos and get stronger. I mean, if somebody said, you know, what are you doing for your exercise? I watch exercise videos. That's what I do. You would go, there's something missing there. But what if they were frustrated and said, I probably spend 2 hours a day watching exercise videos and my body is not any stronger? It must be the fault of the videos. It must be the fault of the exercise programs I'm watching. Maybe I should watch other videos. No, if we're watching an exercise video, we got to get off the couch and practice. If we want healing and transformation, if we want to be free, if we want to be liberated, I mean, all those things that we say we want, well, we can't, it's not going to happen just by good wishes and good aspirations and reading the books and watching the videos and, it's going to only happen when we get off the couch and practice. Where we practice in life. So this is important. So I want to share a little bit from Thich Nhat Hanh, Thai, this week, in terms of talking about what's going on in our society, based on the last week. We saw, we all saw the same thing. And hopefully you didn't let it overwhelm you. Hopefully you didn't become addicted. Hopefully all that didn't happen. What did you do when you watched it? Did you see it? How deeply did you see it? Did we really want to go deep and understand what are the causes? What are the causes that America has the highest death rate and infection rate in the world? What are the causes of that? When we saw the violence, the anger, did we stop and go, what are the causes of that? That's the Buddhist way. When the Buddha encountered the suffering of the world 2,600 years ago, he didn't give in to despair. He didn't give in to hatred. He didn't give in to superficial explanations. He looked deeply. What is the cause of this? Where is this coming from? We have a new president elect. For some people, that's a moment of celebration. For many people, it's a moment of funereal. Right? That's the nature of things. When I was reflecting this morning, I thought, isn't this interesting? Just going back, this is a little history, and I may not be accurate, but you know, depression in the 20s, Herbert Hoover produced what? Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Franklin Delano Roosevelt produced Dwight Eisenhower. Right? Boom, boom. Dwight Eisenhower produced John F. Kennedy. Boop. John F. Kennedy produced Nixon. Nixon produced Carter. Carter produced Bush. Clinton. Bush. Obama, Trump, Biden. What's that about? What's that about? As Buddhists, we have a methodology of looking deeply so we understand the unfolding of causes and conditions. Why? So when we act, we can act in meaningful ways. Buddhism describes samsara, our world, so to speak, the world of ignorance, as a wheel. And the wheel just keeps turning. And at the center of the wheel is a hub, and on the hub, it goes up and it goes down. Goes up, it goes down. It's the world of change. It appears like it's going somewhere, but it's a wheel. It just keeps going round and round and round and round. And human beings keep going round and round and round and round. That is what the Buddha saw. And out of his deep desire to get at the cause of it, he turned inward. And out of his deep desire to share what he had learned in order to help suffering beings, he spent 50 years tirelessly walking the dusty roads of northern India, sharing what he had learned with whoever would listen to him. And he formed a community. He didn't just, it wasn't just him and a few disciples. When people began to gather, he made a decision to form a community. A community that was called a Sangha, that lived in a certain way, that related to each other and related to others in a certain way. This was his answer, you see, to what he saw. This endless circling about in the world. This endless back and forth. And he decided that his Sangha, the community, would be the ones who are living and practicing the way that he teaches, the Dharma. That he would provide something very different for sentient beings. It wouldn't just only be sermons, it wouldn't only be talk, that he would gather a group of human beings who would actually practice the teachings. And it would manifest in the way they lived with each other, in the way they became, so they would be truly a lamp for suffering beings. And that radical response, it's funny, I was thinking of the word radical, you know? You know, we have to be very careful, my friends. We live in times when religion and religious groups is part of often the divisiveness within our world and society. That various types of religious denominations line up on either side of the political social divide. Just another kind of reification of identification of divisiveness. A community, a Dharma community, should be a refuge for everyone, whatever their political views, whatever their social views. I mean, I'm going to read some of Thich Nhat Hanh soon, but this is very important. There has to be a place where people generate enough openness, enough caring for everyone that sees beyond political social views. You know, I looked up the word radical because I thought, well, what is Buddhism? Well, Buddhism in a certain sense, I mean, is very conservative. We want to conserve human values. We want to conserve the things that are most meaningful in this life. We are conservatives. We are progressives. We want human beings to progress in their capacities, right? We are progressives. We are conservatives. We are progressives. But really, what we really are, we are radicals. The Buddhist teachings, the Buddha was a radical. Meaning he went to the root. I looked up the word radical today. Especially in relation to change or action relating to or affecting the fundamental nature of something, far-reaching, thorough, similar, thoroughgoing, thorough, complete, total, entire, absolute, comprehensive, exhausted, root and branch, sweeping, far-reaching, wide-ranging, extensive, profound. The Buddha offered his world a profound, thoroughgoing, comprehensive way out of this endless back and forth. And that endless back and forth is not just political, as I just said, it's personal. We're endlessly going back and forth. We love, we hate, we're happy, we're sad, we're successful, we're unsuccessful. Right? That's us. We're clear. We're confused. I mean, I could go on and on, right? The Buddha offered us as individuals, as well as society, another way, something that went to the root of the problem. And something that offered a radical different vision of what a human life could look like. And not just as individuals, but as a community. He formed a radical community. I mean, his monastic community was very radical, right? They had no possessions. They had no dwellings. They were totally reliant on the generosity and well-being of the people of their culture. They lived in harmony and awareness. They developed protocols and rules that allowed them to deal with conflict in a way that didn't lead to divisiveness and breakage. I mean, He developed a community as a model for what was going on in society, where people divided themselves. I mean, he opened his community to untouchables, which at that time was unthinkable. He opened his community to women. I mean, I'm talking his monastic community, which at that time was unthinkable. That's how the Buddha took his stand. People think, oh, a community should take a stand, which means they should put out polemics, you see. They should hold up posters. I'm not saying that's wrong, but I'm saying the best stand you can take is in our life. The best stand we could take is to create a community that truly lives its values, that walks the walk, doesn't just talk the talk. Funny, what comes to mind, you know, when I was young, now I'm 75, but when I was young, in my latter teens and 20s, college student, etc., I was very idealistic. I got very involved in civil rights. I was going to school in Baltimore, got very involved in civil rights, got very involved in the student movement. Communities that had, there were communities. Because not only did we have a kind of a social vision, but we also socialized with each other and partied with each other and had relationships with each other. We were a community that came together because they had these social ideals. But one of the things that struck me, I don't think I understand it more now than I did then, but that even though people who had wonderful ideals that brought them together, when they got together and acted together, they were just like everybody else. There were power struggles, there was divisiveness, there was backbiting, you know, relationships, people still cheated on each other. You know, people did all the things that everybody else in society was doing, and the only thing that separated them, they had these different social ideals. But very personally, it was same old, same old. Because there was no personal vision of transformation. There was no personal responsibility to become the person, to become the world you want them, you want the, to become that which you want the world to be. It was always, well, if we do this, 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 and this, then we'll get the world we want. And it wasn't until I encountered Buddhism that I realized, no, that's crazy. Right? Seeds produce a specific fruit. Right? Tomato seeds don't give you chard. Papaya seeds don't give you mangoes. Unwholesome seeds don't produce wholesomeness. And it wasn't really till I encountered Thich Nhat Hanh that I really saw the actualization with it, you know, in his very simple statements. If you want a peaceful world, become a peaceful person. Oh. You know, it was like the light went on. Oh. If you want a world free of anger, get rid of all your anger. If you want a world where people are loving and compassionate to each other, learn how to be loving and compassionate to everyone. Oh. I think you understand that. Let me read a little bit from Thay. again, and I've shared some of this before, and you may go, oh, here goes Fred again with his communities of resistance. But, you know, here goes the world again. And here goes people spinning out again. And we need to keep returning to what we're about as individual practitioners and as a community. So again, Thay Thich Nhat Hanh, this is back in the 60s. He talked about creating communities of resistance, but not like the French resistance, you know. It wasn't just a simple resistance against war and violence. He says, the purpose of resistance is to seek the healing of yourself in order to be able to see clearly. I think communities of resistance should be places where people can return to themselves more easily, where the conditions are such that they can heal themselves and recover their wholeness. Is either political party advocating this? Creating communities where people can heal themselves and return to their essential wholeness? In such communities, you meet people who symbolize a kind of freshness. Their look, their smile, their understanding is of help. And then he talks about how to create that. There has to be places where human beings of all kinds, of all political suasions, of all race, of all whatever, can come and heal. Not, you know, you know, not like in a you know, going to a spa for a week. But because there are real human beings there who have gone through their own process, their own healing, their own transformation, have learned the skills that they're able to offer all human beings, no matter what their political suasion is, an opportunity to change. You know, we saw, it's funny, you know, it's so easy to be superficial, right? You know, you saw those images of the people storming the Capitol. It's so easy to be superficial and just see the external of it. But when I looked more deeply, I thought, these are people in despair. It's only people in despair that feel their only out is violence. These are people hurt and angry, no matter what kind of bravado they put on. How do we get to that, you see? How do we heal that? When people believe they're not heard, and lots of people in this society believe they're not heard, no one hears them, no one cares about them. Right? Then they act out. And they act out in irrational ways. Like who? Like us. You know, I get a kick out of so many people going, well, look at all these people, they don't, you know, they don't wear masks, they don't do this, they don't do that. I mean, it's called what? Denial. It's pervasive in our society, right? I mean, most people who suffer deny they're even suffering, right? Most people live in their own fantasy world, believe what they want to believe, right? I mean, we have a name. I mean, we. Many people live in a world that is faith based, and I'm not getting into. There are lots of good people. I'm saying, but it's interesting. Faith based means what? It's not based on facts. It's based on faith. When people live that way. And I'm not saying there's something wrong with faith, but it opens up a can of worms for other things to be, you know, that I can believe whatever I want. I can create my own reality. In the Yogacara, there are three natures to human beings. Their imaginative nature, their dependent origination nature, and their true nature. The first nature, which most people live in, is their imagination, which is means their thoughts. And most of us live in a world that's created by our thoughts, right? We love this one, now we hate him. Why? What's changed? We changed our thoughts. Before this, we're against. I mean, it's just our thoughts are endlessly changing. We live in the world of this fabricated world. And we realize that when people are not grounded in dependent origination, which means the unfolding of causes and conditions, but live in their imagination, their first nature, and once that gets unhinged from kind of a concrete consensual reality, anything is possible. Any belief is possible. So don't be surprised if you're talking to people and they tell you things that they believe are real, are true, and you go, wow, this person's nuts. I've had a couple of encounters like that. It's like, I just listen and go, wow, unbelievable. What these people are telling me is true. And I understand, oh, they're just lost in their thoughts. That's constantly being reinforced by the media, by the people they respect that lead them. I mean, it's, you know, what's an alternative to that, you see? More divisiveness, more me versus they. More misunderstanding, more judgment. It's funny, I read this thing. It was somebody, I guess a reporter, who went into the Capitol with these people. And they talked about, it's like after they got in, right? After their anger and other, they got in, they're kind of walking around in the main hall going, you know, it's like they're awestruck. Many of these people have never seen such opulence. You know, it was very interesting. It's like, oh, you could see their amazement that other people live in such luxury. I mean, this is our Capitol building. But that gave you a sense of their own suffering, their own impoverishment, their own awareness that that there are those that have and those that don't have. Take refuge first, this is coming back to Thai, to take refuge, first of all, to take refuge in the island of ourselves and then in the island of Sangha. These are communities of resistance. This is from another book. Resistance does not mean to oppose others. It means to protect ourselves, like staying inside the house to protect ourselves from the weather. We resist being destroyed by society's pollution, noise, unhappiness, harsh words, negative behavior. If we do not know how to take care of ourselves, we may get wounded and be unable to help others. If we join with others to build a Sangha that can nourish and protect us and resist society's destructiveness, we'll be able to return home. A true Sangha is always therapeutic. To return to our body and mind is already to return to our roots, our true home, our true person. With the support of a Sangha, we can do that. Anyhow, let me just share something else. Again, you know, there are many Buddhist teachers today. There's many Buddhism, There's much Buddhism, there's many Buddhist teachers. But Thich Nhat Hanh, he's a great being as a Buddhist teacher, because he saw something that most others didn't see. And this was the importance of community, of a community of resistance, of an alternative model that we need to create for our society, both personally and collectively. So I'm reading now from a book called Calming the Fearful Mind, A Zen Response to Terrorism. So he wrote this in the early 2000s, I think around 2005. He said, I've heard some people predict that the 21st century will be a century of spirituality. Personally, I think it must be a century of spirituality if we're to survive at all. In our society, there's so much suffering, violence, despair, confusion, so much fear. How can we survive without spirituality? Is that clear? I mean, who's saying that, you see? Not too many. Once again, we're being offered a change of administrations, a change of policy as the way forward. And again, I mean, things will constantly unfold according to cause and conditions. It will be a way forward, but we have to see, as I just said earlier, such and such and such created Obama. Obama created Trump. Trump creates, I mean, it's back and forth, you know. And those on whatever side they're on, if their side wins out of millions of votes by 2,000 or 10,000, they claim victory. But the people who lost by 10,000 or 20,000 are not happy. They're resentful. And they will seek, to get back on top. I mean, this is the way of the world, the way of samsara, the world of duality. This creates that. That creates this. There can't be an up without a down. There can't be an east without a west. There can't be a good without a bad. There can't be a right without a left. Just endlessly, everything is just mirroring. Buddhism says, let's step back and look at the whole thing. Is there another way forward for me as a human being, as a person, and for society, for my families? In the same book, Thay says, despair is the great temptation in our society, in our century. Despair and anger, fear. Alone we are vulnerable. If we try to go to the ocean as a single drop of water, we will evaporate before we arrive. But if we go as a river, if we go as a community, we are sure to arrive as an ocean. We all need a community, a sangha, to prevent us from seeking into the swamp of despair. Now, despair doesn't necessarily mean that you walk around depressed and in despairing. It could be something that's like inside us, and therefore it moves us into pleasure seeking. It moves us into hedonism. It moves us into endless involvement with our electronic devices and games and all this stuff, you see? So we don't have to see the fundamental despair or hurt or anger or meaninglessness of our lives. So don't think it just is like a despair with a capital D. There are many things that are supporting the movement in our society, the swamp of despair. It's like a Scrooge. He didn't know another way. He would have never on his own found his way out of his misery, and he didn't even know he was miserable. I mean, he is the archetype of a deluded being. It all seems so normal to us. Our ideas seem so normal, so rational. And the people who do it differently seem so irrational or stupid or jerks or all the things that we think about people who don't see it our way. Of course, they're looking at us in the same way. There has to be another way. And then Thay says, community building is the most important action of our century. How can the 21st century be a century of spirituality if we do not take up the work of building and strengthening spiritual communities? As individuals, we have suffered tremendously. Individualism is predominating. Families are breaking down. Society has become deeply divided as a result. This was 15 years ago we wrote this. For the 21st century to be a century, of spirituality, we must be guided by the spirit of togetherness. We should learn to do things together, to share our ideas and deep aspiration of our hearts. We have to learn to see the Sangha or our community as our own body. We need each other in order to practice solidity, freedom, compassion, so that we can remind people that there's always hope. And then he says, building safety through communication. I mean, you know, here it is. And he was writing, after America began the Iraq War, if you remember, in response to the, we know now it was completely fabricated, but you remember it was supposed to be in response to 9/11, right? So we attacked Iraq. And Thay said, this is not going to work. You know, no matter how much war, how many weapons, how much billions you spend on killing people and destruction, that will never keep you safe. Human beings want to be safe, right? All human beings want to be safe. Americans felt they didn't feel safe after 9/11. So what do? We thought, oh, I know how I'll be safe. I'll perpetuate violence against those who I feel threaten me. And we know that, that didn't work. It didn't work, and it created more terrorism, more violence, more hatred, more divisiveness, which means what? We feel less safe, right? I mean, we accept that to go on a plane is to go through security. I mean, that's normal now, isn't it? Look at all the things we have to do to be safe. You know, we create more and more behaviors that create conditions for for being less safe, and yet we think we're creating conditions to be more safe. It makes us more scared, more anxious, more worried, more it's, you understand. So Thay says, communication is the practice of our time. We live in a time when there are so many sophisticated means for communication, email, telephone, fax. I mean, he doesn't even know about what's really going on. Yet it's very difficult for individuals, groups, and nations to communicate with each other. When we can't use our words to speak, we use our bombs to communicate. Again, think about what we saw this week in the Capitol. When we arrive at the point where we can't communicate with our words, we have to use guns. We have succumbed to despair. We have to learn how to communicate. If we can show a group we are in conflict with that they have nothing to be afraid of, then we can begin to trust each other. Only the practice of deep listening and gentle communication can we help remove the wrong perceptions that are the foundation of anger, hate, and violence. Yeah, so I'm sharing this today because we are still in the beginning of a new year. And many of us, set out on January 1st with the most wonderful of aspirations and intentions. And yet this past week may have thrown us off our game. If anything, this past week should reinforce to each of us the necessity of fully embracing a willingness to heal ourselves, to free ourselves of our afflictive emotions, to really rededicate ourselves to learning how to love, to learning how to love each other, to be compassionate, to be understanding, especially to those people that are difficult. And everybody has their own criteria. Again, we have to create communities. That takes time, that takes energy, to create a community, a true Buddhist community that lives in harmony and awareness, that practices what it preaches, and that has enough solid mass that it can really be there for others. So we have a lot of work to do in our community to develop ourselves. The more we have a critical mass of healthy people, the more others that we can support. If we don't have much of a critical mass, our ability to support others will be very minimal. Because the main way to support others is not just by giving talks. I mean, you can, there are millions of Dharma talks you can access. But there are not that many communities where people can join together with others and live the Dharma. We are entering difficult times, my friends. Right? I mean, I'm not a prophet, anything but I think anybody who looks at the way things are unfolding in the world, I haven't even talked about climate change and disruptions, knows, humanity is in for challenges, difficult times. And we need to rise to the occasion with our bodhisattva attention to be there for each other, to be there for the world, to offer protection, and to offer a methodology of transformation. That's what the Buddha did 2,600 years ago, and it's still true today. We don't just have an ideology, we just don't have a metaphysical position, we just don't have, any of that. We have a methodology of teachings and practices that work. They've been tested for 2,600 years. I'm not saying Buddhism is the only one. I would hope that there are thousands and millions of other paths of transformation. The world can't have enough at this point. We are just one small drop. But we have to make our drop in this greater world a drop of significance for the benefit of the world. Personally, our families, our friends, etc. So Thich Nhat Hanh's book is called Calming the Fearful Mind, one of many. I've just sort of scratched the surface. Any questions? Maybe we have a few moments. Just chat them in to Maggie. Maggie's on the computer. If anybody has any questions, please chat them in. Yes. What was the first thing about communities of resistance? You know, it was taken from Thich Nhat Hanh. There's a book called The Raft Is Not the Shore. It was a dialogues that went on in the 70s between Thich Nhat Hanh and Father Daniel Berrigan, a Jesuit priest. And it was in their discussions where they talk about communities of resistance. Yes.
How do we begin to heal a world that suffers from much racism?
Yeah, I think the first thing we need to do is heal ourselves in terms of that. You know, the Buddha, there's so many isms in this world that we have imposed on each other. You know, the Buddha teaches all beings are Buddhas. All beings are essentially have the capacity to be awakened beings, all beings. The rich, the poor, the black, the white, the young, you know, to me, this is the most greatest antidote to all kinds of isms, all kinds of hatred, all kinds of intolerance. You know, racism begins, like all kinds of isms, all kinds of hatreds, all kinds of intolerances, begins in the, it's a disease of the mind. It's where we see people as the other, as different from me. Buddhism teaches everyone is the same. The Bodhisattva way, the essence of the Bodhisattva way is all beings are just like me. Everybody wants to be happy. Nobody wants to be suffered. To me, that is the greatest antidote to all divisiveness and discrimination. Just to acknowledge, this person is just like me. Yeah, I don't want to be pulled over by the police and manhandled. I don't want my son or daughter to be. They're just like me. I mean, it's so simple. I mean, I don't know why it's so complicated. I think it's complicated because people are lost in thoughts and conditioning. To me, that's the most powerful thing there is. All beings are just like me. All beings want to be happy. Nobody wants to suffer. So therefore, what? I want to create a world where that operates. I mean, you know, I realize people write all kinds of books and they're all kinds of, but to me, if you just practice that, if you saw all beings as no different than yourself, which is a fundamental teaching, it's a teaching. You don't have to be a fully enlightened Buddha. You don't have to have deep realization and meditative experience. That helps. That certainly helps. But just as a concept, all beings are just like me. I mean, everyone's a child of God, right? Isn't some religions, they say, everybody's a child of God. Oh, well, if everybody's a child of God, then we're all brothers and sisters. So how could I distinguish myself and say some are more worthy than others? You know, all these isms, they're symptoms of a sickness in the human mind. Buddhism goes to the root, to the human mind, where we see anger, we see hatred, we see, you know, we see these things as diseases of the mind of an unhealthy person, and we have a methodology for becoming healthy, for cultivating wholesome mind states, understanding, love, compassion, patience, you know, all these things. As I said earlier, the Buddha's response, and again, you know, if you go to India and you know about untouchables, you know, it's racism. I mean, it's basically seeing, it's one people go look at other people and saying, you're less than me. And what was the Buddha's response? No discrimination. Everybody's welcome in our community. Everybody has the potential to be a Buddha. And he taught everybody indiscriminately. I mean, what better response to that? You know, to create a community of real human beings of all types, open to everybody, where everybody treats oneself equally. Everyone respects one another. One doesn't distinguish this one from that one because of their race or their ethnic group or their gender or their sexual orientation, all these ways that we divide ourselves up. This is a sickness. I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh says, the 21st century has to be an age of spirituality. You know, this is a very different agenda than what's given out in the world. You know, I can just speak personally. When I was a civil rights worker back in the 60s, you know, we used to do these kinds of things, these kinds of exercises. You know, here we are, what, 50 years later, people are still doing these exercises. Why is there still, why are these ways that people divide each other still so present? Because people, well, I won't go into it. I mean, I think you understand. There has to be another way. You know, it is ignorance to keep saying, well, because something doesn't work, I just have to do it more and more. No, sometimes things don't work because they're not getting at the cause. What is the cause? Now, a lot of people aren't going to get at it because a lot of people in our society have ideas. They think they know what the cause is because they've read a book or they've gone to a workshop or they've done this. But look into your own mind. You know, you'll see what is the cause. Why, if I ever discriminate against another human being because of any of these reasons, what's going on with me? Obviously, anybody who discriminates against anybody else begins with a place of what? Me. I'm better than. You know, and it's very reinforcing to the ego, which is a fundamental teaching of Buddhism, you know, that the ego is a source of delusion. You know, if people can feel better than somebody else, just, I mean, look, it doesn't get easier than that, right? Right? I'm better than somebody because of the color of my skin. I mean, it's crazy. And yet, people believe, people kill each other. You know? Anyhow, other questions? And then we need to stop.
Just one on, can you repeat what the three worlds of the Yogacara were?
I'm actually giving a class on the Yogacara. starting a couple of weeks. So if you're interested in Yogacara, which is very fundamental kind of Buddhist teachings related that comes out of India, that's sort of fundamental to Zen and the Great Perfection, really all the Enlightenment traditions, Mahayana Buddhism, is the Yogacara. So please take that and you'll learn. Otherwise, I'm sure you can just Google the three natures according to Yogacara Buddhism. That's Yogacara. Good, so why don't we thank you all. Again, this is a new year. And if anything, these events of the past week should really inspire us, fire us up to practice more deeply and sincerely, both as individuals and with our community. Thank you, everyone.